He saw thought that the paper would have alpha and gamma. He said it looks like alpha and gamma, you know, alpha. And so he wanted somebody with beta in between. So it would be alpha, beta, gamma theory. So on his own, he put the name of Betha, who was a distinguished nuclear physicist who had worked on stellar nuclear astrophysics, and he just put his name in the paper and sent it, even Betha knowing about it, and he sent the paper for publication and told the editor that he's putting Betha's name. So the publisher asked Betha that this is a paper which has come from alpha and gamma and they want to put your name in it. Is it okay? So Betha looked at the paper and said that paper looks good. So he said, oh, okay, you can go ahead and put my name. And so the paper became known as alpha, beta, gamma paper. And Gamma spent some time looking for somebody called Dieter or Delta to extend it to alpha, beta, gamma, delta, but couldn't find anybody, so called it a day. So Betha, although his name appears in the paper, did not have any actual contribution to make, although he agreed with the whole philosophy of doing it. So alpha, and then later on, alpha and Hermann, there are two other these two students of gamma, they were more daring, and they made a prediction that if all these reactions were going on, there must be a lot of radiation around, and that radiation today would be found in a cooled form and you will see it as microwave radiation. So let's look at the next slide. That radiation was detected by in 1965 by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson with a horn-shaped antenna which is shown in the back. Now Penzias and Wilson did not know that such a prediction existed, and they were using this antenna to look at some microwave radiation in the galaxy, and just by chance they found that while they were checking the accuracy of their instrument, that there was this radiation coming from all directions, not particularly from the center of the galaxy, but all over the sky. And they were worried whether this was an experimental error, some kind of a noise in the instrument. But they could not find any source of noise. And later on, when this news got around that they had found this, cosmologists began to relate it to the earlier prediction of alpha, Hermann and gamma, that there would be a relic radiation from the Big Bang times. And that is how the microwave radiation, which was detected in 1965, became a signature of that early history of the universe. Let's look at the next slide. Now, this was the measurement made by Penzias and Wilson was somewhere here, this point on the curve, how much intensity at what wavelength. Then it was subsequently measured at different points. And more recently, in the last 2 years, it has been measured on this side, which is difficult to, impossible to do from the ground because of atmospheric absorption. So it was done in a satellite called COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer. And beautifully, the whole curve fits the points, and it is the theoretical curve one would expect from what is known as black body radiation, which is radiation trapped in an enclosure. I won't go into details, but simply say that this becomes a very good confirmation of the whole idea which alpha, Hermann, gamma had put forward. So this led to physicists suddenly getting interested in the Big Bang cosmology. So during the 60s, rather during the 70s, physicists began to take notice of the fact that such a prediction existed, it was verified. And so the universe must have been very hot in the past. And then they said, how hot? So as I said to you, that gamma was quite daring in his times in 1940s to say that I will look at the universe when it was 1 second old and when its temperature was about 10 billion degrees. So and in those days, the physicists had felt that this was too big a speculation to make. How can we calculate anything about the universe when it was 1 second old? So they had dropped the whole idea of cosmology as a serious subject in the 40s. But what happened after this confirmation came, that people said, okay, gamma was after all talking sense. So let us see what the universe was like, not at 1 second, but even earlier than 1 second. So if I put 1 second, the temperature was, I'll put 10 to the power 10 Kelvin is the absolute scale of temperature. For all practical purposes, you can take it as Celsius, it makes no great difference. So it was 10 zeros after 1. So people began to say, what if we went further back in time to shorter intervals after t equal to 0? Let us say 0 is here when the Big Bang occurred. So between 1 second and 0, you can go on making smaller and smaller division. So you can say 10 to the minus 2 seconds. That means 1/100th of a second. 10 to the minus 2 is 100. What would be the temperature? Well, like that you can go. What happens is that the temperature time relationship is there. So the further back you go, you will find that this may go to 10 to the 11. And you can go on further down the scale. And so as you go down and the temperature rises, all the constituent particles which were present in the universe would move very rapidly. They will have extremely high energy. And so particle physicists felt that if the universe was so much active, so hot, then those particles would be very energetic and they would therefore interact at very high energies. I want to show you the next slide. You see, that is related to how much total energy is contained in the radiation. See, the radiation has certain amount of total energy per unit volume, and that gets distributed at different wavelengths. And the theory tells you that it peaks at a certain value, because the total area under the curve has to be finite, it has to be equal to what you are given. And depending on the temperature, the peak wavelength is determined. So the higher the temperature, the shorter is the wavelength where the peak occurs. So that is known as Wien's law in black body radiation. So it is all confirming that particular. Yes. No, what happens is that you have sensors which measure here, you know, now this has been measured, you know, and you find the curve extends quite well. But there are no individual sources producing this radiation. It seems to be coming all over. That is the main idea. That now this is a particle accelerator in Fermilab, where what people do is they produce in this tunnel, it is a big sort of passage through which particles are made to go round and round and collide at great speeds. And then physicists study how the new collisions occur, what happens afterwards, and that way they understand the nature of physics at very high energy. And one of the interesting frontier areas today is to understand whether the different interactions, that is the nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, gravity and so on, they all become unified, part of the same interaction at very high energies. And for that you need to go to high energies much higher than what this accelerator can produce. And although the Americans are now building a superconducting super collider, which is more powerful than this and can give you energies say 100 times more than this, what particle physicists need is several orders of magnitude more than that. And that they know they cannot ask any government to build, because it's technologically not feasible to produce that kind of an accelerator. So they have turned to the universe as the accelerator, because the Big Bang universe in the very early stages could generate particles of extremely high energy. And they are concentrating their overall attention at a stage when it was 10 to the minus 36 seconds old. That means take 1 second, divide it by a large number. The large number is 36 zeros after 1. So, and then you will get a very tiny part of the 1 second period. And in at that fleeting moment, the interactions, according to the present theory, must have been united. That means they were all part of the same picture. And some interesting thing might have happened at that time. And so, okay, now there is a relation between the temperature and time. And temperature tells you the energy of the particles. The faster they move, the more is their temperature. So particle physicists have their theory which tell you at what energy the particles would be under a unified system of forces. And that energy determines the temperature, and that temperature determines the time when that temperature operated in the universe. So that is a logic. So, I mean, one need not take 10 to the minus 36 as the figure, but it is somewhere in that region. And I'm illustrating it to show that yesterday or the day before yesterday, I was talking of long times and long distances. Now I am going to the other extreme. There are very short times and very tiny size the universe had at that time. So there is an interaction, connection between the very large and the very small, which is emerging from considerations of Big Bang cosmology. And this can be used. I mean, one can ask, what is the outcome of these calculations for astronomy or cosmology? Can we get any new input? So I want to give you, what's that? Well, the temperature, there is a time temperature relationship which is fairly simple that, let me write here. The temperature goes as 1 over square root of time. See, so what I have got is square root of time I have would give me another power 10 to the 18. So about 10 to the 28. Kelvin. I mean, it's something completely unimaginable by any. Was that?
The
yeah, it comes from the Big Bang cosmology. Yeah, you know, the standard cosmological model. So, I want to show you some indications. Let's look at the next slide. Sorry, this slide has come the wrong way, but doesn't matter. You just look at the shape. This is this relates to the rotations of our galaxies. I was talking about how galaxies rotate. And the rotation of the galaxy is determined by how much matter is contained in the central part of the galaxy. It is like the sun which swings around all the planets. And the further you go, the speed of the planet becomes smaller and smaller. So what people expected was that if you confine, this is the center of the galaxy and you go outwards. And the visible mass in the galaxy is confined to this region. So if you go further out, the velocity of rotation around the galaxy should drop down. And but measurements of neutral hydrogen cloud, which are possible by radio astronomy, showed that these lines are speed is still continuing. It has not dropped down to zero. And the interpretation of this is that this is happening because there is still matter around which we cannot see. It is dark matter. So just as you have in economy, there is white money and black money, and the black money cannot be directly seen, but its effects can be seen in the dynamics of the economy. In the same way, you have here dark matter, which is not visible to astronomers, but whose gravitational effect is seen through motions of visible matter. So that is how the dark matter, how much dark matter is there, can be inferred, just as you economists make guesses how much black money is circulating from the overall activity. So there is a great deal of analogy with that. Let's look at the next slide. I showed this slide earlier as cluster of galaxies, and these galaxies are moving, but there is also suspicion that there is great amount of dark matter in between, because the motions that you see in these galaxies are much more than you would expect if they are just interacting with themselves, with one another. There is much more force there, moving them around. So the dark matter may in fact be even as much as 10 times the visible matter in the universe. This is the conclusion people are coming to. And what the dark matter could be made of is a great, highly speculative subject these days. Nobody knows. Each one has his own pet theory. But all these are linked up with what happened in the very early stages in the universe, because that is where dark matter was also made. So people are at the moment having a interesting time between nuclear physics, particle physics and cosmology to see whether we can make sense of what is seen cosmologically and what is being speculated by particle physicists at two extreme ends. This is a very large scale figure, but the origin of matter in this must have come at the very early stages in that, as I showed on the blackboard. Let's look at the next slide. I'm sorry again, this has come out the wrong way, but the this is Glashow's, who's a Nobel Prize winner in physics, Glashow's snake, which is the modern version of the Sheshnag, which the snake is following its tail. So you see this snake is following the tail. This is to illustrate in modern cosmology a kind of interlinkage between the very large and very small. So if you start here and go this way, you are at the very small end at the tail, and you are talking of the very small sizes and very small times after the Big Bang. And this is, if you can invert it, you can see GUT, this is Grand Unified Theory, which means all these different interactions getting unified. So you go on making bigger and bigger, you come to the atomic structure, then you come to the Earth, and then you come to the Moon, solar system, the stars, galaxies, and the whole universe. And as I mentioned, when you start going to bigger scales, you are forced to think of what happened at the very small scale. So that is how this whole circle is completed. And that illustrates the present feeling in cosmology that the very large must have is linked with the very small. You cannot understand one in isolation. Particle physicists cannot make any progress with their very early very energetic physics unless they test it somewhere, and the only way they can test it in the universe in the very early stages. And the cosmologists, if the Big Bang theory is right, would have to go back to particle physics to understand some of the mysteries of what the universe was like. So this is one point I wanted to make. You can turn this off. What I now want to come to is a somewhat interesting idea, which I was interested in for a number of years. I'm still interested and keep coming back to it. And I thought I should end this with my lectures with this, so that it may set you thinking about the whole process. This is to do with the time asymmetry in natural events. You know, when we look at any natural phenomenon, we always get the sense of that the time is going one way. I mean, we always say we are not getting any younger. That means our evolution goes only one way. And you find this in many different ways. The first one is, of course, biological changes. Where from birth you are young and old and then goes to death. This is how living systems operate. And you see, you have a feeling that in the space you can go left and right, top and bottom, or north, east, west, south. But in the time sense, you are only going in one direction. So there is a kind of asymmetry. There are other ways time shows up, and that is what is called thermodynamic effects, which lead to order and disorder. Now, if I take a cup and drop it on hard floor, it will break. Now, before it broke, it was in the constituents of the cup were in a highly ordered form. But when I dropped it and it breaks to pieces, it becomes a disordered form. So there is a connection, that there is a transition from order to disorder. You never happen to see the reverse happening, that the pieces are lying, they come together and the whole cup becomes formed. That never happens. So there is a one-way process. Then in electromagnetic phenomena, there is again a one-way process. What happens is, there is radiation from any electrical circuit. Now you have an oscillating circuit, or you have in your radio or television, waves are coming out and they are carrying the information. And if you did not have your power supply, whatever circuit was producing those waves, those electromagnetic waves, will ultimately die out. So you always have the system that if current is going backward and forward, radiating, and ultimately if you left the system, the radiation would stop. You never have the other way, that radiation comes in onto the system and the system starts getting more and more currents. So it's always one way. Then there is time asymmetry in cosmological structure. As I mentioned to you in this slides, galaxies are separating from each other and there is expansion. You don't see galaxies coming to inwards. So you can, looking at when I had those balloons, I had one smaller balloon here and a bigger balloon here. If I was not told any arrow in between, but I was asked to say which was first, I would say the smaller balloon was first and the bigger balloon was later, because I know that cosmological observations tell me that there is an expansion going on. So there are these different ways in which these arrows are manifested. And the question comes in, are these arrows, different arrows, related? That means these arrows of time, is there a unique fundamental arrow of time which determines or which connects all these? And does fundamental physics explain why such an arrow should exist? And this is a question which has bothered physicists as well as philosophers as to why we have a unidirectionality of passage of time. So I want to present a few thoughts on this, and I will explain to you in this way, just where the symmetry of laws of physics comes. You know, we know that the space has three dimensions and time is the fourth dimension. The physicists express this by saying that there are three coordinates, that is east, west, north, south and height. So you can say x, y and z to specify the location in space, and one coordinate for time. Now if you change x to minus x, it means reflection in space. So if I am standing, this is a mirror, and I measure my distance from this as x. Now my reflection would be on the other side, it will have the coordinate minus x because it's exactly at the opposite distance. Now if you are familiar with reflections in space, but as I said, reflection is time. In time we don't have, that is, from a given instant we always go forward. But if you ask the laws of physics whether they have anything in them which makes this distinction, that they only prefer time going one way, the physicists will tell you that the laws do not single out a unique sign of time. That means the time, according to the laws, the time could go either way, they don't care, because the laws are perfectly symmetric. And to illustrate this, I've got examples. Supposing you've got a box here, and you make a compartment, and you put gas here and empty vacuum here. Now, if you wait for a while, if you remove this compartment and wait for a while, what you would find is that the gas gets distributed over the whole box. The vacuum gets filled. Now, this is according to physics, that the particles are moving. Now it is perfectly possible to get hold of each and every particle and reverse its motion. And if that happens, all the gas will promptly flow back into this. But this never happens. You only see the upper part of this thing, this going into this, but not this going into that. This is where the arrow or asymmetry comes in. But physicists or the laws of physics don't tell you that only one should happen and the other shouldn't. Here I have got an oscillating electric charge which is radiating energy. This is what electrodynamics tells us. You don't have a situation where the energy is coming onto the charge and the charge is getting more and more energized. This never happens. Similarly, here you see galaxies all moving away. If you ask Einstein's relativity, is there a model in which the universe could contract? The answer is yes. The relativity theory gives you equally well a model of a contracting universe. But that means all the galaxies are coming inwards. But you don't see that. The universe seems to be expanding. So why is this happening? This is the basic question. Well, what I am saying is that when you have a dipole, electric dipole, which is oscillating charge, you set it going, what happens is that makes it radiate energy. Now, there are equations for this, describing this. You can solve the equations in which you will get another solution in which energy is coming into the charge. Where it is coming from, we need not worry, but that kind of solution also exists. I will come to that shortly. But you don't see that phenomenon happening. You only see the charge radiating out energy, but not receiving energy. And slowing down. That is the distinction between these two figures. Very briefly mention a certain chain of ideas which existed. In 1800, there was Coulomb, who first found the phenomenon of electrostatic attraction or repulsion, that if you have unlike electric charges, they attract each other, like charges repel each other. People began to wonder whether Coulomb's law actually works in all cases, and people found that Coulomb's law does not work in all cases of electromagnetic phenomena. And things like radiation, where energy is going outward or coming in, and electric charges are moving very fast, you can't explain this with Coulomb's law. So there was work by Gauss, who speculated on why this is not happening. And Gauss's analysis was that Coulomb's law doesn't work because it tells you that action and reaction between two electric charges are instantaneous. That means if you have an electric charge, I move it, another electric charge will feel the effect instantly. That means there is no delay. And Gauss felt that there should be some delay, such as speed of light should be involved in taking the influence from here to there. But he did not actually work out how this could happen. Then there were Schwarzschild, Tetrode and Fokker, who tried to give expression to Gauss's ideas between 1900 and 1930. And Wheeler and Feynman in 1945 and 49 wrote two very important papers in which they showed that once you start bringing in this action at a distance as Coulomb had, but going at, I will come to that very shortly, then you automatically bring in the universe. And then there was later work by Hogarth in 62 and Hoyle and myself in 63 to 71. So I will just give you a march of ideas to show how this thing happens. So let us first consider action and reaction between two electric charges. What we do is, on this chart, you take this way as space and this way as time. So if you take an electric charge A and electric charge B, as it moves, at different times where it will be located, you will find along this line. Now, if something happens to this electric charge, if it wobbles or moves, the influence would travel from here to there, to the other charge, with the speed of light. So the effect would go like this in a diagonal way, and what happened here would be conveyed here at a later time. Time is going upwards here. And the reaction of this charge from there to here must come back instantly along the same path, and what you see is that it is coming backward in time. So this is one of the peculiar features. Supposing you say that at 4 o'clock this charge suddenly moved, then, and if this charge, the light took 1 hour to go from this to this charge, then the effect will be felt here at 5 o'clock. But the reaction of this charge, Newton's law says that action and reaction are equal and opposite. So the reaction of this will come back in time at 4 o'clock, which means the effect is propagating backwards in time. And this is something which worried people a lot as to how this can happen. So here, any effect which goes forward in time is called retarded. An effect which comes backward in time is called advanced. Advanced meaning we know the information in advance. That is the jargon. So it comes backward in time. So both these advanced and retarded signals are present. So if you really look at what is happening between two electric charges, I take an electric charge here at this, in this room, let us say. We call this the origin and call this A. This is the charge we are having in this room. And then we consider electric charges which are moving at different distances all over the universe. Now you do something to this charge. You take a hammer and knock it, let us say. Now, there will be a signal which will go forward in time. It will hit this electric charge. And as I was explaining here, that other electric charge will send a reaction back. So if you start it at 4 p.m., and this was one light hour away, this will be felt at 5 p.m. But the effect of this back on this, the reaction will come back at 4 p.m., which is instantaneous. Was that back at 4 p.m.? See, Newton's law says that action and reaction must be equal and opposite. So, when you take the action is propagating along this. This is how the influence is propagating. And if it has to be equal and opposite, it must be exactly reversed, you know, along this arrow. And I know what is bothering you, or which bothered many people, was that how something that happened at 5 p.m. could influence something earlier. You know, that is the problem. There are paradoxes. That is, if you could send some signal backward in time, then you could kill your grandfather before he had any children, and then there is a contradiction. How did you exist? Like this. So how do you get around this problem? This was in fact the basic idea that I am trying to explain.
The reaction and reaction are felt at this point at the same time.
At this point, the effect is felt at the same time, because at the moment it started sending a signal, the reaction came back. Because
there is no paradox.
Well, let me come to that shortly. But this, let us at the moment follow the logic of the whole thing.
So, hammered it.
Yeah, that will be instantaneously. That's a mechanical reaction. But because the electric charge. No. The point is the hammer was a means of accelerating that electric charge. No. Yeah, so when it was moved, because of movement, it radiates any effect, the electric effect, and that effect I am taking, the electrical effect, and that is bound to be there. You, what's that? It could be electrical. Yeah. I'm only making a symbolic hammer here, so just to accelerate. You may have some magnetic field or something to do it. Press a button, some impulse goes, it knocks the charge like that. So what I'm at the moment drawing your attention to is that when in 1945 Wheeler and Feynman were working on this problem, they came to this result that if you take this theory very seriously, what it means is that when a charge starts accelerating, it feels the instantaneous reaction from this at 4 p.m. back. What has happened is that action went, the reaction came back, and that is how the charge moved. But I said one light hour, but that one light hour was just by way of example. If you took this charge, which was say one light year away, the same thing would happen, because there is nothing special about one light hour. This fellow would feel the reaction, not only from this, but from everyone, everywhere in the universe, instantaneous. And so the conclusion that Wheeler and Feynman came to was the fact that the moment you start moving an electric charge in the laboratory, the entire universe reacts back instantaneously, no matter how big the universe is. And so their argument was that something, the overall large-scale structure of the universe has something to do, some very important role to play in the local movement of electric charges. And then they left it at that. They did not pursue it very far, because they were not basically cosmologists. They were interested in the motions of electric charges in electrodynamics and so on. But later on, Hogarth and Hoyle and myself, who were interested in the cosmological angle, we were struck by this idea that if the whole universe interacts or reacts back to what happens to an electric charge, the large-scale structure of the universe must be taken into account in seeing how an electric charge moves. So we looked at the cosmological models, which are models of the expanding universe. We found that the universe itself has an arrow of time, which means expanding, and so as I illustrated, all galaxies are moving away. And so that arrow of time of the cosmology has something very important to do with the arrow of time in the local phenomena. So there was a link between what we call the cosmological arrow and the electric arrow, electrodynamic arrow. And what we were able to show basically was that because the universe is expanding, we can argue that when an electric charge oscillates, it radiates energy. It does not receive energy. It's only a one-way phenomenon. I'm giving this synopsis of a very large, very big piece of work which went through several logical steps. Because I want to draw the bottom line here, that when you look at the electrodynamic arrow, all you see in the local laboratory is the fact that whenever there is an oscillating electric circuit, it is radiating energy. You don't worry as to why it is radiating energy and not receiving energy, because both could be possible according to equations of electrodynamics. And there seems to be one way of resolving this problem as to why it chooses the radiating outwards mode, because when you consider the cosmological arrow, when you take note of the fact the universe is expanding, then you understand the linkage between the charge and the whole universe. And I mentioned to you Olbers' paradox in the early part of this lecture, why the night sky is dark. That was again an indication of how our local environment is linked with the overall structure of the universe. You cannot ignore that. And this is what I am, this is another example of somewhat similar nature, but going more deep than the Olbers paradox did, which tells you why cosmological arrow is linked with the electrodynamic arrow. To finish, I also want to mention that there are certain lacunae in quantum mechanics where There is this so-called uncertainty principle, and the example of Schrodinger's cat, as to you probably know this example which Schrodinger has thought of, that you have a closed box with a device which can be triggered by some gamma ray ejector, and that device would activate a gun which could shoot a cat which is kept in the box. Now you don't know until you open the box whether the cat inside is alive or dead, because you don't have the complete predictivity in quantum mechanics as to whether if there is a nucleus which is radiating, giving out a gamma ray, whether it will do it or not, whether it will stay where it is or whether it will give out a gamma ray. So there is a uncertainty involved in understanding the local behavior of a small microscopic system. And this has led to to considerable discussion on foundations of quantum mechanics. It has many other examples. Einstein, Podolsky and Rosen had concocted another paradox, which is called the EPR paradox, which also has been discussed at great length. Now all these tell you that there is something of what you would call incompleteness in quantum mechanics. Incompleteness in terms of not being definitive in predictions. And this is considered an inherent property of quantum mechanics. That once you go from Newtonian mechanics to quantum mechanics, you lose the complete predictivity of what the system will do. There is an uncertainty. What I am trying to now consider trying to hint at is that when you take a local system and try to understand what is happening in it within a purely local framework, you are ignoring the interaction the system has with the large scale universe. And because of that, you are in a way considering the system as incomplete in its total predictivity. So it may well happen, and this area is something that needs to be investigated much more than has been done, whether the overall nature of quantum mechanics, the foundations, have can be enriched if one takes into account the interaction between the local system and the whole universe. I think I will stop here. If you make a division between two groups of organizations, so I would put here the university sector and the other is institutes. There are various research institutes which are there, so I will tell you which these are. There is in Bangalore itself, there are three institutes where this is done. One is, of which I would put the IISc is a deemed university. So I will put it in the university sector. They have a group of astrophysicists and a very good group of big group of theoretical particle physicists. So this question I was describing of grand unified theories, how the very small and the highly energetic physics interact with cosmology, that kind of work is done here. Then among the institutes, there are the Indian Institute of Astrophysics in Bangalore, and then the Raman Research Institute. These two are in Bangalore. Then in Bombay, there is TIFR, which has several different branches. There is a group of theoretical astrophysicists who work in various aspects of theoretical applications of astrophysics, including cosmology. Then they have a large group of astronomers, including radio astronomers who are now located in Pune, next door to our institution, So TIFR has a branch in Pune who do radio astronomy. Then space astronomy is done in TIFR itself. Then there is the physical research laboratory, Ahmedabad, which is also doing work on this. Then in there is a very good group of physicists in the Institute of Physics at Bhubaneswar, and they are planning to get interested in astronomy astrophysics.
Bhubaneswar.
Now of these are IIA, RRI are both under the DST umbrella. Then TIFR and Institute of Physics are in the DAE, within the Department of Atomic Energy. PRL is in Department of Space. So that is the broad description. Detectors for putting on the backs of telescopes so that one can make good observations. We are also developing small automated telescopes for use by university groups. And then, apart from these, then there are about, I would say, 10 to 20 universities. I say 10 to 20 because I don't know the exact number, and the range of interest in the university department varies. It's not very uniform. In some places, there may be just one person interested. In some places, there may be a viable group. So our inter-university center has the mandate to bring these groups together, make them, many of them are at the moment subcritical, to make them more vigorous. So these groups are invited to come and visit IUCA, use its facilities, and thereby get this like battery charging, which we have in other places. And this is now beginning to happen, and it will grow as our own facilities improve. Now,
Do we publish any journal?
None of these organizations publish any scientific journal of their institute, but they publish their papers in established research journals in India and abroad. The best known Indian journal in astronomy astrophysics comes again out of Bangalore. It is called the Journal of Astrophysics and Astronomy, and it comes under the umbrella of these two organizations generally. It was started by Venu Bapu and then has taken off quite well. There is also another journal called the Bulletin of Astronomical Society of India, which is also reasonably good. Our center brings out a bulletin, which is something like a newsletter, which comes out every quarter, telling what we are doing, who are visiting us, what kind of workshops, schools, conferences we are going to arrange or be arranged. And this we can send to people who are interested in our activities. This it has a fairly large mailing list, and that keeps on growing. And the frequency of this bulletin will increase when our active tempo of our activity also increases.
You mentioned about this automated telescope that you make for the university.
Yeah. In the visible part of the spectrum, and it will have automatic guiding facility, and it's an optical telescope, something like 14 inch. Yes, it can be used for student training and even for instrument testing. That means you want to test the instrument before using on a big telescope, it can be done. Now this we have put a proposal to DST under this project scheme, and this program advisory committee of DST has approved it, in the sense of if we can find a university group who wants to work and make this telescope. The condition, DST's condition was We should not make it and give it to a university. They should come and make it in collaboration with us and take it back. So it has to have an active interaction of university groups. So we are trying to motivate some university group to come and do it. Dr. Trivedi has a cynical smile. DST won't have to spend the money. Anyway, well, we are yeah, let us see how it works. It's a new experiment. We have to essentially start out of zero, you know, in the university system. Any it's possible, yes. We are in fact quite open to having people from technical side to come. Yeah, that would be very useful. Yes, and not only our institution, but also the GMRT project of TIFR in Pune, the giant meter-wave radio telescope, with considerable electronics involved. And Professor Swaroop is all the time complaining that he's short of talent, people who would help in planning. So it's a quite an exciting type of assignment if it can motivate somebody to come. And the person can pick up a lot of sophisticated electronics know-how in doing so. So I think that sort of thing would be extremely useful. Yeah. I think that's a good suggestion if it can be followed up. Because engineers are in demand in astronomy. Somebody was asking, I think you were asking about asteroids and comets. Indian Institute of Astrophysics has a program for observing asteroids. And comets, of course, as and when they come, people are, it's not predictable when a comet will come. And new comets keep coming all the time. It's not like Halley's comet that it comes. Every comet is known to come after a certain period, because many of these comets are long period comets. That means a comet comes today, it will come after 1,000 years or so. So Halley's comet is somewhat of a special case. It comes every 75, 76 years. So one can prepare in advance. But any new comet which comes is sighted well before it comes into the vicinity of the Earth. So observations can be geared up to match its arrival. So this IIA people are best equipped for it, because they have the best telescope in Kavalur, this 90-inch telescope called Venuvaku telescope, which is then they also have a 40-inch telescope. Then in there is also, I should mention one more place, that is the UPS, Uttar Pradesh State Observatory in Nainital, who also are now using CCD equipment. They are run by the UP government. UP government. They come under the UP government umbrella. I think they would function better if they became autonomous institution, not a government, part of a government department, because they are facing a lot of bureaucratic hurdles. But still they are trying to come up. They have a 45-inch telescope. It's a fairly good one. And the site is good near Nainital. In among the universities, Usmania University has a 48-inch telescope, and unfortunately it needs a lot of upkeep and repair, which the university within its own budget is not able to meet. So they are trying to get some special grant to set it going. Then I think this is broadly the spectrum of what astronomy has done. We have brought out a leaflet or booklet called Careers in Astronomy, which we send to any student who inquires about what are the prospects, what is happening in astronomy. So it's a colorful brochure which we have brought out and we send it to the students. So if you come across any student at whatever stage, you know, he may be a 12th standard or even 10th standard student who is motivated, you can ask him to contact, him or her to contact me. This is, we would like to spot talent wherever possible because it's rare in this field. And you see, that's what we try to make out in the booklet, what is happening. No, the number of facilities are coming up in the country now. There is a new telescope coming up in, it has come up, but it needs to be to be completed still. It's PRL, the Ahmedabad, the infrared telescope. Then something is coming up in RRI and so on. And the GMRT is also very big project. So the question will come up in another 3-4 years time, where are the users of these facilities? So we would need scientists who would work either in these institutions or they can also find appointments in the physics departments of universities. There is no suggestion that astronomy department should be opened in the university because that doesn't work. You need to have them as part of the physics departments. Comets are believed to be formed in a big cloud which surrounds the solar system. It's very far away. It's called Oort cloud. Oort. Oort is a very distinguished scientist, now over 90 years old. He proposed this idea that there is a source of comets in the form of a cloud much beyond the Pluto planet. You know, it's solar system as we know it, planetary system, is rather compact compared to the influence of the sun. It can extend much beyond. So chunks of essentially ice, dust, various kind, when I say ice, it doesn't mean necessarily water ice, but frozen gases and so forth. So that whole combination of gas and dust is a chunk of, it is attracted by the sun, it comes towards the sun, goes around and goes back again. And then again it comes because it gets into an orbit in this process and visits. Now, when it comes near the sun, the solar wind, the wind coming out of the sun and sun pressure of the sunlight, both act on it, and the heat of the sun first melts it and evaporates, produces gases in gaseous form. And the pressure of the solar wind and the sun bring out a tail. You know, so, if the planet is, comet is coming, this is the sun where I am sitting, is coming towards me, then the pressure of the sun's solar wind and radiation. Yeah, wind, there are particles coming out of the sun, you know, that is called solar wind. And the radiation of the sun pushes this thing in the form of a long tail. And the tail can be very long. It can be as long as the distance between the earth and the sun. You know, it can be really very long tail. You've got a very long tail like this, and at the end, in the front part, is this real chunk of matter of the comet. So when it comes to the sun, it goes round, you know, and then goes, heads back. So when it heads back, you know, the tail is always away from the sun. You know, so it, the tail also turns like that. Push back. No, it's the sun which is, no, that sun's attraction acts on the main body of the comet. See, the tail is very light, No, and that is also coming with it. It is coming with the comet, but the length of the tail and the why it is stretched out is because it's being pushed.
That's it.
No, no, it is all part of our solar system. There is nothing beyond that is needed for comets. Yes? Mm-hmm. The tail increases as it approaches the sun. Shrinks, yes. Because that you can see in some of the pictures of the comets, which are photographs taken and so on.
How do you predict when the comet will appear?
How do I predict? See, just as the Earth goes around the Sun in 1 year, and Mars, etc., they have their orbits. Each orbit has a period. So, cometary orbits are also ellipses. That means they are sort of round but very long, like egg-shaped, but they are very long eggs. So, once you see a comet come close and measuring its different positions in the path and its velocity, you can work out the orbit and say when will it next come. And in case of Halley's Comet, this has been done several times, and it has a relatively short period. 76 years is a short period. So Halley's Comet is much has been visited, sighted so many times, and it has been worked out properly. There are other comets which come, which have been sighted for the first time, but whose trajectories show that they are very long period comets.
And orbit of the comet is farther than the farthest planet.
Yes.
Nothing in between.
Yeah, we have not. You mean beyond Pluto? That so far we have not found any new planet. Yeah, certainly many of them go well beyond. There are some which are remaining short, but most of them are very long, longish. They can't interfere with the path of the planet, but the planets can interfere with the comet's path, because the gravitational field of the planet is much stronger than the gravitational field of the comet. Yes. What was the are you talking of Paramhans Tiwari's work?
Yes.
Well, I had seen this work. I was not convinced by his claims. You know that he claimed to get energy from ether. In ether is something that is supposed to fill up the whole space. It's not the ether that we use in chemical laboratories, but it's an hypothetical substance. And most physicists believe that there is no such thing as ether, but there are a few people who think there is. He is one of them, and he thinks that ether plays a role, and he can produce energy from vacuum or space. But I have not seen a convincing demonstration of that claim. I've only seen newspaper reports. Yeah, that's right. But again, the place which awarded the prize is also not scientific, authentic place. So I don't want to comment on the. He was in the power project division. Yes. That project, successful, then the DA in the plant. Why? Was that?
That fusion story spread all over the world.
Cold fusion.
Cold fusion is the level. Cold fusion is for a few hours.
Yeah, I mean that did not survive. Yes. Yeah. Well, when the Big Bang occurred, the temperature was literally infinite because all the matter was infinitely dense and so on. But when the expansion started, that is a few moments after that, if you make the assumption that there were a large number of particles present and they were in constant interaction and in that what you call thermodynamic equilibrium, that means as much energy was being given out by one, by received by the other, and exchange was happening frequently, that helps to establish a temperature. And you can then calculate the temperature using the thermodynamics at that time, and that tells you what the temperature should be at a given time t. And what I wrote down was basically a time temperature relationship. That is, well, the cause is not known. It's like asking the entire matter which we see in the universe or the radiation, what caused it, where did it come from? So that came out of the primary creation event. That is what the Big Bang cosmology says. How it came there is, we don't know. So in that sense, the answer is not complete. Then your second question was the particles and volumes. Now, first of all, we don't know what state the particles were in the very, very early stages. Certainly, when you talk of protons and neutrons, at 1 second, they were there as protons and neutrons. But in earlier epochs, they may have been more like quarks. Quarks are the components of protons and neutrons. And neutrons and protons are are also composite particles. So their constituents were quarks. So there is a possibility that when this was 10 to the minus 36 seconds, there were no neutrons and protons present, but there were quarks present and electrons and neutrinos and such particles. But this is based on the particle physics we know of at present, and which also may get modified. Now, when you have very fast moving particles, very energetic particles, then the amount of volume they occupy gets very small. This is again one of these quantum mechanics results. And so the entire population of the universe was compressed in a very short time. For example, you can make an estimate of the size of the universe at any given time by multiplying, if the speed of light is c, then multiplied by the time t, that is the age of the universe. That is the kind of characteristic size of the region. So if you have 10 to the minus 36 seconds for the time, the speed of light is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So this will be the size of the universe. And you can see it is very small, 3 times 10 to the minus 28 meters. And you can ask how could all the electrons and so on be confined to this volume size of this, because as you know, the present size of the electron is quite large compared to this. So the answer is that all these particles were highly energetic, so they were confined to a very short volume size, and that is how it's supposed to have happened.
Right, that
it's zero. Yeah.
That
would have been
zero, yes. Right?
That's right. Another point that I wanted to mention, see, the size of the particle, etc., comes from quantum mechanics, the idea of quantum mechanics, how you can localize it. Classically, could have been point particles, but quantum mechanical, they can't be localized in any given region. So there is a characteristic region over which that particle would exist, and that region gets smaller and smaller if the particle is very energetic. Now, I was talking of 10 to the minus 36 seconds, but there is another epoch which was before that, which is called the Planck epoch. I will write it Planck, of the order of 10 to the minus 43 seconds. It is much smaller than 10 to the minus 36, and that is the epoch when the rules of quantum mechanics would apply to gravity and to space and time. So the suspicion is that when you come down to that kind of a time, beyond that, I think between zero and that, you cannot talk of space and time as coordinates or dimensions. The whole idea of what you call space and time may itself become nebulous. So the question whether there was a Big Bang when the volume was zero is not admissible beyond this epoch. Well, the particle antiparticle, this concept came first out of mathematics. Mathematics meaning Dirac was trying to, Dirac was one of these early pioneers of quantum mechanics. When he was trying to work out how an electron moves according to quantum mechanics, he wrote down a certain equation which is known as Dirac equation. And when he solved it, he found that electrons can exist with positive as well as negative energy. So there were two types of states he could think of. And negative energy seemed very peculiar to him. So he said that no real electron would exist in the negative energy state. They are all filled up. That means there is no way of putting an electron in that state. Assume that it's all filled up. And then he had this interesting idea that if the state is filled, then you take out some electron from that filled state. When you take it out from negative energy, you have to lift it to take it out. You have to give it a positive energy. Now, when that happens, that particle he called the anti-electron, because it was lifted out of vacuum, it is all filled up. And that became known as the antimatter equivalent of the electron. It was opposite the electron in the sense of, because it was taken out from zero, when you subtract from zero, you become negative. So the charge was positive, electric charge was positive. And so it was called positron. Now this was all mathematical exercise. So whether you could produce such a positron was not clear at that time. But then in the laboratory, people were able to produce the positron through an experiment which produced particles which were similar to electrons but which were opposite charge. Now such matter does not have long life, because a positron and an electron, when they come together, now positron is something like a hole going around, and when the electron comes, it goes into that hole, and it is filled, it is no longer noticeable. So what you see therefore is a positron and an electron annihilating each other, destroying each other. And this happens very fast, because electrons are present everywhere. So you produce in the laboratory a positron, it goes, even in this air there are a lot of electrons, so it will be totally destroyed very fast. So the existence of positrons or antimatter is there, I mean it is established by experiment. You also see them in cosmic ray particles coming from outer space, but they are not in very large numbers because they don't last very long. And so far as negative energy is concerned, the idea of negative energy is there in our dynamics or in our physics. Only thing is, people tend to look upon ordinary forces as having positive energy. But there are things like gravity which have negative energy. So I will explain what negative energy, how gravity comes into effect. So I will give you one paradox or example which explains how negative energy system behaves. I will ask you this question. This is a common sense question. That's supposing you have got two bodies, and this is hot and this is cold. and you connect them by a conducting wire. See, just connect them. Then this is hot means at a higher temperature, this is at a lower temperature. So heat will flow from here to there. Right, so ultimately if you let it go on for a long time, this will cool down and this will heat up until they become equal. See, that is, then the process would stop. This is the normal behavior. Now I want to see what happens when you've got a hot star and a cold star. Okay, and I connect them by a conducting wire. This is a thought experiment. We are not having any wire which will conduct stars like this. But let's suppose it happens. So, this is hot at a high temperature. So, what will happen is that heat will flow from here to there, as it happened here. Now, because the heat has flown out of this star, it has lost some of its source of heat. So, its pressures inside, which were related to that heat, those pressures have become reduced. And there is gravity acting in the star. So, the star will shrink because the pressures have now become weaker because it has lost the heat. So, it will become slightly smaller in size because of shrinkage of gravity. And because it has shrunk and it got compressed, and so it has become hotter. So, this becomes hotter. Right? And here, because it got some heat, its pressures increased. And because its pressures increased compared to gravity, the pressures are now stronger, so it blows up. And because it blows up, it cools down, because any expanded gas cools down. So you have, this is colder. So when heat passes from a hot star to a cold star, the hot star gets hotter and the cold star gets colder, which is contrary to our normal experience which I was describing here. Now why this is happening is because stars are controlled by gravity, their overall size. And once you bring in gravity, all these peculiar things happen, because gravity has a negative energy. So when it compresses something, the strength of gravity grows. Now to give you another example, if I take a rubber band and I stretch it, it has stored energy because it has elastic energy which is stored. So if I give it, release the ends, it will shrink and it will come to its normal size, and all that stored energy is gone. So it has lost energy and it has shrunk to the size. Now if I take gravity, supposing there are two masses here who are attracting each other by gravity. So I'm holding them so that they don't go towards each other. Now if I release them, they will move towards each other. Now the inverse square law says that the closer the particles are, the stronger is their force of gravity. So when I let them go, they come closer, but the gravity has grown stronger. Whereas in the elastic case, the force had disappeared. Here it won't disappear. So it will keep growing stronger and stronger. And that is another example of negative energy, that you have a negative reservoir from which you are drawing something, it is getting stronger. It's like a deficit financing. you owe somebody some money, then you spend much more, you owe still more, and all these numbers get bigger and bigger. And so, it's like that it happens in gravity. I think I'm only speculating, because it is not, yes. If you look at the way astronomy has gone so far, from the past, then you can use that to speculate for the future. In the 30s, people had the impression that the universe is fairly homogeneous and isotropic. That means it looked the same in all directions and is homogeneous, means everywhere there is the same density. But in the last 50, 60 years, people have found that universe has much more structure and there is a hierarchy of structures. So first people were knowing only about galaxies, then they knew about clusters. Now they know about superclusters. So my feeling is that as you improve your observing technique, you will develop ability to spot even higher structures. But you will not come back to a stage where the universe was very simplified and homogeneous. It will turn out to be much more complicated than before. So all the existing theories, the Big Bang theory or the one which I am now trying to propose, are probably taking too simplistic a view of the universe. And it may happen that the reality is much more complicated. Well, I would find going to the market much more difficult than doing cosmology or queuing for at the ration shop and so on. But I would like to make some comments on astrology, because this I get asked by different people at different times, different forums and so on. The question is whether astrology is a science or not. This is what people like to know. So my saying that it is not a science and saying that that's all is not a scientific reply, because I must say why it is not a science. You must give some scientific reasoning for it. So I would like to tell you what has happened over the last 30 odd years, certainly maybe earlier also. Scientists have studied the astrological forecasting system to see whether it has the predictivity that science demands. You know, that when you make a prediction in an experiment and whether you observe it, you know, that has to be precisely defined prediction, then you can make the observation whether you see it or not can be clearly decided. So the clarity of prediction and the discipline of observing that prediction, verifying it, these are part of the scientific discipline. So when you apply them to astrology, you find that it doesn't stand up to the scrutiny. I will give you some examples, and there are many examples, but I will give you a couple of examples. And these are all from US. We should do more such studies in India, because there is nothing very high technology about them. It just requires scientific planning. What they did was they picked up at random a large number of couples, you know, who had been married long back, and asked for their birth dates, birth times and all that. And then asked some astrologer to cast their horoscope and then decide on the basis of whatever astrological wisdom exists whether these couples match or not. You know, the horoscope matching that takes place for fixing marriages in India, similar criterion they were trying to see. So whether the couples, their horoscopes match for a happy life or not. So they came up with and said so many pairs their horoscope match and this group their horoscope don't match. No, the astrologers gave this division of the two. Then they examined what had happened to those couples. So they found that in some cases the marriages had broken off or were unhappy or divorced. In some cases they were happily married. But who were happily married class and who were the broken marriage class had no correlation statistically with the divisions which astrologers had made on the basis of their horoscopes. So this is one way of testing scientifically a prediction made on the basis of astrology and then showing that it doesn't come up. Then there is also another very interesting test made by another group of psychiatrists, and this was to do with what they call the Barnum type horoscope. Now I will tell you what Barnum type horoscope is. Barnum and Bailey was a circus in US. And they asked Barnum, who was the owner of that circus at some stage, why is it that your circus is so popular? So he said that in my circus, I have several different acts. And when the people come, there is always something which would interest somebody. You know, some people may like the trapeze act, but may not be interested in the tigers or lions. So, but there may be some who don't like trapeze, but may like the clowns. So he had catered for every taste. So they all come and watch the circus, and that is how it is popular. So in a Barnum type horoscope, you describe the person's characteristic in a very vague and general manner so that it will apply to any person. No, it is not. But when a person reads it, he picks up only that which applies to him very significantly. So they constructed, the psychiatrist, they constructed one Barnum type horoscope. And then they called a group of people, again the subjects on whom experiments were to be made, took their birth date and cast their genuine horoscope and their characteristics as interpreted by the astrologer. So if you are a person from that group, your features, character and everything will be given by the astrologer based on your horoscope. So that, let us call this horoscope 1. Now they did it for all the people in the set. So they would give you another horoscope which belongs to somebody else. So let us say some person here, you know, his horoscope will also be given to you. So you have got two horoscopes. Then they will give you a Barnum type horoscope to you, that three horoscopes you have. Then, and you were not told which is which. And this was done for all. So they got their own interpretation, then somebody else's, and then the third one which was Barnum. And they were asked to say which one fits them best. No, they were asked to judge on their own which one is the most correctly matches their personality. So, invariably all of them picked up the Barnum as number 1. Then number 2 and number 3, they could not make any distinction. In some cases, their own, they picked at number 2. In some cases, the third persons. And so this is another way of showing that this doesn't mean. So I would very much like such experiments carried out in India to reinforce this conclusion.
Friends, we had a very interesting time with Professor Nallikar for the last 3 days, who had to a large extent removed the mystery around what is known as cosmology, and finally also mentioned that there are many more mysteries to be unraveled in the future. If one were to think reflectively, I think we have been all stargazers right from our birth, which we carry throughout our lifetime. Most of us are told that unless a moon was handily available, we did not take our dinner during our childhood days. And when it comes to depart from the world, I think our gazes are always towards the sky. And in between also, I think most of us are stargazers of a dubious kind of human stars. I was once hearing the Professor Swarup when he mentioned about, when he was talking about radio astronomy, he mentioned that nature is a very jealous guardian of its secrets, and then it only gives a few bits and pieces about its own nature over a millennium of years. To say something about it, we could not have had a better person than Professor Nallikar, who is one of the stars in the scientific firmament. He is a teacher, as you could have really realized during these 3 days. A person who has written books for the popularization of radio astronomy. And on top of everything, what impresses everybody when he comes into contact with him is his sense of modesty. which I think is very difficult to achieve in a person who has had this much of scientific endeavor in the very few years he has dealt with so far. I found that Professor Nalikar made a wave not only by his work with Dr. Hoyle, as well as when he returned to this country, or when he was wanting to return to the country. I was just talking about it during the tea time. I remember that lecture which Professor Nalikar gave at that time, immediately after his publication of the results. This was chaired by Dr. C.D. Deshmukh as Vice Chancellor in Delhi University. When it came to the Professor Nalikar's lecture, he mentioned that Indian conditions do not worry me. All I need is only a chalk piece. And C.D. Deshmukh was very quick enough to point that some of the blackboards in Delhi University may not write well with his chalk piece. Well, we have come far off from that kind of a condition, and it is really to the credit of Professor Nalikar that he chose to stay with us in India and become one of the proud sons of this country. And it gives me great pleasure to express my gratefulness on behalf of all of you to Professor Nalikar for the time and effort he has put in to be with us this morning. Thank you very much.